In Paradise Lost, John Milton pondered, what hath night to do with sleep? I don't know. Not much, I suspect. But I'm up, and you're awake, and I'm the richer for it. Welcome to Coast AM. I'm Richard Serrett, coming to you live from Coast's Toronto affiliate talk radio AM 640. Back in 1957, R&B artist Nappy Brown recorded a little ditty for Savoy Records called The Nighttime is the Right Time. Perhaps you've heard it. The nighttime is the right time to be with the one you love. And hopefully you and the one you love are settling in for 4 hours of Coast to Coast. And if you're not with the one you love, my wish for you is that wherever your love is tonight, they're looking up at the very same moon you're staring at, and they're listening to Coast along with you. It is Friday night, time to let our hair down. You know the drill. The last half of the program is open lines, and you'll get to jump in and co-pilot and steer this ship wherever you wish. And Friday night is also a time to contemplate our place in the universe, to gaze at the stars, to imagine a world that exists beyond our five senses, and to go beyond science. And we'll go beyond science in just a few minutes with Tara McIsaac, the Beyond Science reporter at the Epoch Times. And for those of you not aware or unfamiliar with the Epoch Times, it's a print and online newspaper that publishes in 21 languages in 35 countries across five continents. And Tara has written a truly revelatory article on something that gets a lot of airtime on this program, namely the near-death experience. The headline of her latest article is Leaving Their Bodies. These People Saw Things Later Verified. And her article lays out a pretty cogent argument that NDEs, or near-death experiences, are real. Not just the result of what the materialists might dismiss as a temporal lobe seizure. In the article, McIsaac provides compelling evidence, not just a laundry list of anecdotes, but evidence that near-death experiences are real, and it seems a growing list of medical practitioners are finally coming around and willing to consider, at least, the possibility. Dr. Sam Parnia, for example, a critical care physician and director of resuscitation research at Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York, he's leading something called the AWARE Project. AWARE is a worldwide study designed to continually and methodically gather NDE data and identify such cases. In participating hospitals, patients who are revived after cardiac arrest and whose brains had stopped functioning with their bodies clinically dead are asked to report what they felt, heard, and saw, if anything. And as I say, Tara McIsaac will be here to discuss some of the most remarkable cases from the AWARE study. And she'll delve into some case studies where patients whose brains had stopped functioning later, after being revived, reported that they had left their bodies. These people saw things that were later verified by medical practitioners. Verification, evidence of the near-death experience. But before we delve into near-death experiences, I believe Lex Lonehood last night posted a great story on the In the News section at coasttocoastam.com from Outside Magazine, The Body Electric. Every year, more than 500 Americans will be struck by lightning, and roughly 90% of them will survive. They remain among the living. Their minds and bodies will be instantly, fundamentally altered in ways that still leave scientists scratching their heads. When people and lightning meet, death is an unlikely outcome. An average lightning bolt, get this, carries 500 megajoules of energy, enough to instantly boil 250 gallons of water. It heats the air, it zips through to five times the surface temperature of the sun. Still, again, 90% of lightning strike victims survive. Over the past three decades, lightning has killed an average of 51 people per year in the U.S., but little more than 500 injured and alive. But left, rather, more than 500 injured and alive. And those that survive are rarely ever the same again. Many suffer from lingering physical ailments, and most find their personalities are changed profoundly. Many survivors have also endured symptoms that are remarkably similar to those of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a great article, and I think a must-read, but it might just be a great subject to toss around during our open lines later in the program. I'd love to hear from people who've been struck by lightning. I'd like to find out how it's changed your life, and the lives of your loved ones. A few years ago, I had a chance to meet and interview an orthopedic surgeon in upstate New York by the name of Dr. Tony Chicoria. This guy was a workaholic. He was devoted to his medical practice. Then, in 1994, at a family picnic, he was struck by lightning and had a near-death experience to boot. He experienced the typical short-term memory loss, tingling sensations, numbness. Then, as he recovered from that, music began to fill his head. He had a song in his head, and he just couldn't get rid of it. The problem was, with no formal musical training, he had no outlet, no way to get this song out of his head. And so, he became obsessed with learning to play the piano, all in an effort to get this song out. Eventually, after learning to play, he composed and recorded and performed what he would later call the Lightning Sonata. One bolt of lightning, a near-death experience, and one devastatingly haunting, beautiful piece of music, all out of the blue. So get your struck by lightning stories ready for our open line segment a little bit later. But first, a fleeting glimpse of the afterlife here on Coast to Coast AM. Tara McIsaac is a Beyond Science reporter for Epoch Times. She explores the new frontiers of science, delving into ideas that could help uncover the mysteries of our wondrous world. Tara, welcome to Coast. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me. I'm great.
Let's lay our cards on the table, Tara. Before you delved into this subject matter, near-death experiences, how would you describe yourself? Would you say that you are a materialist who believes that once, you know, you're dead, it's the worm buffet, or were you open to the idea that there is an afterlife?
I was certainly open to the idea that there's an afterlife. I'm interested in looking at, you know, like you were saying, the examples of cases where it can be verified or proved in any way, scientifically studied, but I did come at it from the perspective that there could certainly be more than what we see materially or what we currently see materially.
Now, is that based on any personal experience, or is that just based on your own research?
I've not had a personal near-death experience. I would consider myself a spiritual person, so I guess in a lot of ways I feel like I've experienced, you know, something beyond the world that the materialist would see, but I haven't had, you know, a near-death experience that would, you know, make me think that this for sure exists. I've only heard the secondhand accounts and read the research on it.
And recently, I understand, you attended the International Association for Near-Death Studies. They had a big conference in I think this year it was at Newport Beach in California. You were there, correct?
Yeah, I was. It was really great. It brought together a lot of the people who are doing research in this field right now, a lot of the experiencers, and there were a lot of different aspects of this issue discussed there.
Well, I wanted to ask you about some of the attendees. Are they let's talk about the panelists that attend. I mean, give me a sense of the makeup. I mean, are there people from sort of orthodox mainstream medicine there as well, or are they mainly what, you know, might be considered sort of on the fringe type researchers?
There was a mix there for sure, but I guess I went to the panel discussions that featured some of the more mainstream scientists. That was a bit more what I was interested in, and it's not to, you know, trivialize anybody else, but there are people who are psychologists, who are, you know, healthcare workers of various sorts, counseling professor, people who are in academia who are starting to research this. So I definitely went to see what they had to say.
I'd be very curious to learn more about Dr. Sam Parnia. who is sort of the head of this AWARE project, where they're trying to actually document and chronicle or catalog NDEs around hospitals or in hospitals around the world. Tell me more about Samparnia and AWARE.
Yeah, sure. I didn't actually meet Samparnia, but I met a lot of people who talked about his work and referenced similar work as well. So this is underway basically in hospitals all over the world in various regions. They're setting up, for example, during near-death experiences, people often report leaving their body and floating above their body and being able to see things, say, in the hospital room, if that's where they are, or outside the hospital even. So the idea is, if you can have healthcare workers in the hospital aware of this, able to interview, say, cardiac arrest patients who have been revived and ask them what they saw, you can gather data. But also, if you set up certain visual targets in the hospital, and you ask the person afterwards what they saw without leading them to this target, and they happen to report that they saw this thing, that's pretty strong evidence. There hasn't been a really strong case out of that AWARE study, as far as I know yet, that that shows that a person saw that specific target and reported it afterwards. And some of the people or the panelists discussed some of the sort of obstacles faced by this study in some ways. For example, when people are having these profound experiences, they may not notice, as one panelist said, they may not notice that, orange circle with number 5 inside of it on the ceiling or something. They're more focused on this profound thing that's happening to them. But nonetheless, over the years, there have been some cases that where people saw things outside of their body that could be verified later and were verified, that provide strong evidence. And the AWARE study is really good, I think, in the sense that it's trying to, actively gather this information. And the chances, Robert Mays is a long-term near-death experience researcher, and he basically, put it this way. Near-death experiences are rare occurrences, and it's hard to catch them. So the odds of catching somebody who's had one, somebody who's seen things that they can remember, and somebody who's seen that specific target, the odds aren't really, it's not a controlled experiment in a laboratory. It's kind of hard to pinpoint these things, but just setting up this structure and these this awareness in hospitals can really help capture these cases when they do come up.
I want to get back to Parnia for a moment, if I could, Dr. Parnia. Mm-hmm. Now, he is a critical care physician. Explain a little bit about who he is, what he does, and I'm also curious to know, why medical practitioners are even interested in this subject matter, because this is something, obviously we talk a lot about on Coast to Coast, and it has kind of a, I call it the woo-woo factor. It's elements of the paranormal and the supernatural. And as you say, it's difficult to verify these cases. Why do you suppose mainstream medicine is suddenly taking an interest? But first, to my question about Dr. Parnia, tell us a little bit more about who he is.
As far as I know about Dr. Parnia, like you said, he's a critical care physician, and he's a director of resuscitation research at Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York. So he's been leading the project. That's as much as I personally know about him as to why mainstream medicine is maybe starting to open the door to this kind of thing. I guess all I could say was, perhaps it's just that these experiences are fairly common, and it's something that, people, it's really important to people. I guess one thing that I came away from the conference with, especially speaking to the healthcare professionals, was this idea of the compassion for their patients. Medical doctor Mitch Leister, he mentioned specifically, even if you don't believe in near-death experiences or how they're caused or anything like that, the effect that they have on people and the importance that they hold in people's lives is very real, and there's no denying it. So it's certainly something worth looking into.
And in a hospital environment, what are the circumstances under which individual patients are experiencing NDEs? These are people that obviously have been sort of declared clinically dead. But what does that actually mean?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's an important question because a lot of people will say that it's a physiological reason, you know, maybe lack of oxygen or something like that. So, you know, a lot of them, I guess, have been said to be cardiac arrest patients, but actually it's a really wide range of people. And that's one of the arguments against it being a purely physiological, you know, hallucination or something like that, because it could be a cardiac arrest patient, but it could just be somebody who fainted. It could be, you know, somebody who had a brush with death in the war. And actually, there's some interesting research into the, you know, soldiers who've had near-death experiences. And, you know, really the circumstances are as wide and varied as people are. So it's really a universal thing. And that's something that I think the researchers are really interested in looking at.
But we should probably distinguish between the out-of-body experience. I don't want to use the term the garden variety out-of-body experience. There's nothing garden variety about it. But there is a difference, right, between an OBE and what we're talking about here, a near-death experience.
Yeah. The near-death experience, it's funny because they do talk sometimes about near-death-like experiences. So it's kind of, I guess, some of the characteristics of a near-death experience would be, you're in a position where often you're unconscious. Quite often, maybe brain activity has completely ceased. You know, sort of the flatline idea, and then you part of it's the out of body experience, which is common. But then there's also things like a life review, seeing, you know, deceased loved ones who are helping you cross over, or hearing music, you know, various experiences, feeling light and free of the pains of the body, and these kinds of things. And you know, I guess it's pretty much any brush with death. It could be that that somebody's in a hospital and you can clearly see because they're hooked up to the machinery that their brain activity isn't there. But it could be sometimes, you know, out in the field, a tragic accident, somebody, you know, basically life signs are fading, that kind of thing.
But in the AWARE project, they're strictly focusing on cases where they know this individual is clinically dead, where the brain activity is flatlined. So that would rule out some sort of, you know, sensory stimulus coming from the outside, because we know these people are clinically dead. That's what the AWARE project is about, correct? As opposed to someone who may have just fainted outside the hospital and had an OBE.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the benefits of the AWARE study, looking at specifically hospital cases, is that, you know, it is a situation where people will be hooked up to this machinery and they can see, they can, you know, exactly filter for those cases where a person would be clinically dead.
When we come back, we're coming up on a break here in just a few moments. When we come back, I want to talk to you about a particularly poignant a case study. That's Pam Reynolds, 34-year-old individual who underwent sort of a very dramatic brain surgery and had an NDE. And some rather remarkable testimony from Pam Reynolds, which would lend a great deal of credence to the whole NDE experience. But let me get back to AWARE for a moment. Is this, to your knowledge, the first time that mainstream medical practitioners are actually studying this in a scientific way, studying NDEs, that is?
I would say that I wouldn't say that no mainstream medical practitioners have ever studied it. I mean, there's various levels of it. This is certainly, to my knowledge, the most broad and comprehensive study, very well organized. But there have certainly been individuals who've been interested in it who've, you know, done some level of research on things like, you know, the person's ability after a near-death experience to affect electronics around them, which is a common thing. And there have been smaller scale studies.
All right, listen, we'll head into a break. Stay with us, Tara. On the other side, we'll get to the Pam Reynolds case study, which is truly remarkable. And Tara McIsaac is with us, the Beyond Science reporter for the Epoch Times. And her latest article is entitled, Leaving Their Bodies. These people saw things later verified. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. And there they are, the Kinks, bringing us back in. One of these seminal bands from the British invasion. And rumor has it, actually we have it on pretty good authority, that the brothers Davies, Ray and Dave, are willing to bury the hatchet and stop beating each other up long enough to actually get together and play some music in time for their 50th anniversary next year. Wouldn't that be great? A Kinks reunion in 2015. We've got that to look forward to. Here's something else you've got to look forward to. Let's say, for example, you're not a night owl and you're missing out on some great content here on Coast to Coast. Well, for about 15 cents a day, you can have last night's show waiting for you to listen to, and you'll be able to access over 1,000 shows. As a Coast to Coast insider, you can go back 5 years and listen to shows, and you'll also have access to monthly live chats with George Norrie and other guests. And it's real simple. 15 cents a day. Go to coasttocoastam.com and sign up. And do it now. Back to more of my conversation with Tara McIsaac, Beyond Science reporter for the Epoch Times, as we delve into and drill down into the near-death experience. Welcome back to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. Tara McIsaac is the Beyond Science reporter with the Epoch Times, and her latest is entitled, Leaving Their Bodies, These People Saw Things Later Verified. Talk to me about Pam Reynolds, Tara. This is a remarkable case.
Yeah, Pam Reynolds is definitely a remarkable case. Basically, in 1991, she was 35 years old, and she was undergoing a unique procedure in Phoenix, Arizona, to treat a brain aneurysm. And this procedure involved basically bringing down her vitals, you know, lowering her body temperature, slowing her heartbeat, really bringing her to a state in which she's basically clinically dead. To perform this operation. So this is, you know, sort of prime conditions for a near-death experience. And what's so unique about her situation is that during this six-hour operation, she, you know, reportedly left her body, saw what was happening, heard conversations, and was able to report some of the details when she revived. And it was well documented in the medical reports that some of these things happened, and her recounting of the timeline of when they happened seemed to match up pretty well. So it's really a unique case in how well documented it was. So basically, you know, for example, one of the things she heard was one of the surgeons saying that the size of her artery was too small, or was rather small, and in the operative report, the surgeon did write that. And the timeline matched up with what Reynolds heard. So, and the thing is that, you know, then there's this idea, well, maybe she somehow, you know, she heard it through her ears, even though she was seemingly unconscious, you know, her life signs weren't there. Maybe she heard it somehow. But, for example, her ear canals, there were molded ear speakers put in her ears. So even if somehow through all of these unlikely circumstances, when she was in this situation, she was somehow able to hear through normal means, the sound wouldn't have gotten through. So a lot of these alternate explanations were ruled out in this case.
Yes, in other words, these were not simply the hallucinations of a hallucinating brain, or what they often refer to as a temporal lobe seizure. These things can be ruled out. And her eyes as well were lubricated and taped shut, so there was no visual stimulation as well.
Exactly. As you said, Dr. Robert Stetzler, who worked on her, reported afterwards that this temporal lobe seizure was just extremely unlikely in this case. It almost impossible. It wasn't that he ruled that out for sure.
Now, but as you say, the Reynolds case goes back to 1991. I mean, surely there are others. I mean, we can't hang our hat on just one. You know, it is a remarkable case, and we do have verification from, you know, corroboration from other witnesses, but we can't hang our hat just on one case, Tara. There must be others.
There are certainly others. Another outstanding case was one of Maria, a migrant worker who was visiting Seattle, and she had a heart attack, and she was in the hospital, and, you know, reportedly, you know, life signs were gone. She was clinically dead. She left her body, and she floated outside of the hospital. And when she came back, she said that she saw on a ledge a tennis shoe that had, she even gave the details that a part of it was worn down where the little toe would fit, and a lace was stuck under the heel, and she described it in great detail. And so afterwards, somebody went to go verify and went to see if they could find this shoe where she said it would be. And sure enough, it was there. And it was completely impossible for her to have seen it from the hospital room or from any point, you know, from the time she entered the hospital to getting to the room. It was completely blocked from view. So, again, you know, even though some of the examples are older, like the Pam Reynolds, again, it is rare to be able to have a well-documented case. There's just so many factors. I mean, even somebody who goes through an experience like this, so many people are scared to talk about it because they feel like people are going to think they're crazy. You know, maybe the documentation wasn't there. The healthcare workers may not be receptive to this. They may not want to look and verify it. You know, there are such a variety of factors. And again, it's a profound experience, and it's not something that you can create in a lab. So sometimes these really, really strong cases are gold, and they are rare to come by, unfortunately.
I understand that the AWARE project is ongoing, but what's the data thus far? Do we have a handle on, you know, what percentage of NDEs in a hospital environment are verifiable? In other words, the information, the things that the patient who was clinically dead claimed that they saw or heard actually turned out to be true. Do we have any data on that?
I don't have any data from the AWARE study as of yet, but Dr. Jan Holden, who's a long-time NDE researcher, she has gathered all of these reports of what's called vertical perception cases where it can be verified through the literature over decades. And her analysis, she said that 92% of apparent cases where these details can be verified are accurate. You know, what the person says ends up being verified to some degree. 6% have some errors, and only 1 in 93 cases is completely inaccurate. The person said they saw something and it just completely wasn't there.
Let me just go back over those, because this may have just sort of escape some people, because I think this is important. 92% of apparent, they call them vertical perception cases, or NDEs, 92% are accurate. 6% have some errors, and only 1 in 93 cases are completely inaccurate. That's pretty remarkable. I mean, under the rules of evidence, I would imagine you could enter that into a court, and you would win the case.
Yeah, it's definitely very compelling evidence from her analysis of all of the reports that she was able to gather.
But you mentioned Jan Holden does sort of issue one caveat, and that is, you mentioned these visual targets. Explain again what a visual target is, how it's used in the NDE research, and what the data is on these visual targets.
Yeah, well, basically the targets are set up in hospitals. So the impression I get, I think my understanding is basically that it could be something like a, you know, a blue square with a orange triangle in it and the number 3 and 4, you know, kind of these geometric shapes or numbers. And so it's something that somebody can clearly verify. So it's set up in a hospital in an area that should be out of normal range of view. But if a person happens to leave their body during a near-death experience, as they report, and they happen to go up and see this somewhere where nobody could normally see it, and they come back down and say, I saw a blue square with an orange triangle and the numbers in it, then it's pretty good evidence that they actually saw that. One of the things that she said was, when people are going through these experiences, they may not notice or care about a square and a triangle and numbers. They're more, immersed in this otherworldly experience and what's happening to them. And actually, for example, in the AWARE project, basically my understanding is some of the most promising cases have kind of fallen through in a way. One of them because the target hadn't yet been established at that hospital. So it was a promising case in that the experiencer did leave the body and reported seeing specific things, but not the target, because the target hadn't yet been established in that hospital. But it's still hopeful, I think, because it shows that these kinds of cases are being hit upon through even at least the surveying process going on in this AWARE study. The healthcare workers know what questions to ask and that kind of thing. It's hopeful so far, but there are certain limitations. But I think that probably over time and setting these things up more broadly and widely and having more awareness about it, that's what the project's called, AWARE, that's where we're going to get the data.
I would concur with Jan Holder in that if I was having a near-death experience and I found myself, let's say during open heart surgery, hovering above my body, looking down, perceiving, hearing what the surgeons are saying, even though I'm essentially flatlining, the last thing on my mind would be to look around for one of these visual targets and make a mental note, oh yes, it's a green triangle with the number 7 in it. I'll have to file that away when I go back into my body. It doesn't seem like a very good a test. I would think that they could come up with something a little bit better than that to verify some of these cases. And what better evidence than simply the remembrances of the person, of conversations by surgeons and so forth, that are occurring while the patient is clinically dead.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why I'm hopeful, even just with AWARE, the idea that, healthcare professionals and hospitals are creating this culture where you can talk more about it, and that's where these cases will come about. And I don't want to misrepresent the project either. Perhaps they've worked on the targets and established better ones that I'm not aware of. So, and that's the process of learning too, right? That's how these things evolve. You implement something and you realize maybe it has limitations, and you try to look for different solutions.
I would imagine, though, that the failure of a patient to identify one of these visual targets, and as far as we know, no clinically dead patient who claims to have had an NDE has ever correctly identified one of these visual targets. That fact is probably has the materialists and the skeptics sort of rubbing their hands with glee. Are they also lining up now that you've published this article in Epoch, trying to counter this with their own sort of conventional explanations, a more natural, prosaic explanation to explain the NDE?
I haven't encountered, specific counterarguments to some of the strong cases like Pam Reynolds. Not to say that they aren't out there, maybe they are and I haven't seen it, but I think some of the strongest cases probably haven't really, been addressed. I guess, with some of these things, it's a matter of if you really want to disprove it, you can really try to. And if you want to prove it, you can try to. It's so hard to, at the same time, with something like Pam Reynolds, it's hard to dispute, really. There's not much you can say. But, for example, Jan Holden was saying with this AWARE study, she gave an example of what a skeptic could say, even if somebody saw the target, okay, and somebody, saw something that precise and described it. She imagined that a skeptic could say, well, you know, you could probably see that target if you are on a ladder. What if a healthcare worker was on a ladder and saw it and discussed it with somebody else and the patient heard it? Like, you know, you can really try and stretch the imagination to try and explain it away if you really, really want to.
When you attended the International Association for Near-Death Studies in California this year, and you, I'm guessing that you spoke with a number of NDE survivors, if you will. What struck you most about these people? Was there sort of a common denominator that you found with NDE survivors?
I think that yes, in the sense that people who have these experiences, it's a very profound experience, and I don't think that you come out of it necessarily with the same perspective on life. It's, I mean, even just going through from a very mundane perspective, going through a near-death experience where you almost die, that can really change what kind of person you are. But, you know, a lot of the researchers even say that they're really interested in this because a lot of people come back with this sense of compassion, with this sense of what life's really all about. It's a really profound experience, and it can really teach. For a lot of people, it means to them, it's proof of the afterlife. It's proof that there's something more than what we have here, and that can really change people. I think that, you know, from my experience talking to near-death experiencers, a lot of them are extremely logical, very rational and clear about their experience. They've encountered some, you know, negative reactions from some people in their lives, some of them. And they've questioned their own sanity at times, but a lot of them came through it and thought, well, I'm just going to focus on the positive feedback and what I've learned from this. And a lot of the times it's really great life lessons, and they're really compassionate, encouraging other people to share those as well, and really just talking about listening to people who've had these experiences, because it really means a lot to them.
Is it, are the experiences, I mean, do they cut across all cultures, religions? Are the common denominators in place across cultural lines?
Yes, they definitely are, actually. That was one thing that was clear from some of the researchers. Dr. Mitch Leister, who I referenced earlier, has done some studies on cross-cultural experiences, and that's part of what they're using to legitimize the study, really, is that it seems to be a universal experience. And there are some gaps in that study. Jan Holden pointed out that, I believe it's Africa and South America, there's virtually no data on near-death experiences. So there's still more work to be done there. And they also cautioned, you know, focusing too heavily on the similarities, because each one is very unique to the person as well, and they don't want to discount the different types, but there certainly are characteristics that are there across cultures and across time periods as well.
Does the NDE always result in a happy ending? Have you ever met anyone, either at one of these conferences, the International Association for Near-Death Studies, who, after an NDE, was shaken? I mean, had a negative, horrible experience. Perhaps their glimpse of the afterlife was, you know, hellish.
Yeah. I have heard of bad experiences. From my understanding, the vast majority are positive experiences, and so much so that I actually don't have in mind, and I haven't encountered any specific stories myself of bad experiences to relate here.
Do those people that have those experiences, do they tend to show up at an IANS conference? Is that something perhaps that the NDE community, if I can use that term, would rather not have us hear about?
I can't speak for the entire NDE community. My impression would be that I think that they'd probably be open to hearing people relate those experiences and even helping them through it to understand it. You know, and I think you're right. Perhaps people who've had the bad experiences, maybe they don't talk about it as much. And even some of the good experiences can be bad experiences in a way if you don't talk about it. That's one thing that I learned. There's a Colonel Diane Corcoran there. She's actually the president of IANS. And she has worked with military personnel over decades who've had near-death experiences, and she thinks that actually post-traumatic stress disorder can be treated by talking about near-death experiences, and that they're sort of negative experiences until they're talked about and they become okay, and then
they're
positive.
All right, listen, Tara, let's reconnoiter on the other side, and we'll take some calls, open up the phones, and ask people about their NDEs. Are you good for that? Terrific. Leaving their bodies, these people saw things later verified. Near-death experiences here in Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett.